Brought to you by On Service Oriented Architecture, part of the On Podcast Network at Inform IT.
Welcome back for another On SOA podcast with Thomas Earle, best-selling author of 4 SOA books and also the series editor of the Prentice Hall Service Oriented Computing series from Thomas Earle. Hello, Thomas. Welcome back.
Thank you.
In our previous podcast, we've been discussing various SOA design patterns and principles, but I'm hoping we can kind of take a step back today, take more of a big picture approach and talk about SOA in general. In your recent book, published this past July, SOA Principles of Service Design, you discuss the strategic SOA vision and how that relates to the design principles. So I'm hoping we can start with those strategic advantages that everyone's talking about and everyone's heard about with regards to SOA. And if you could just talk a little bit about what an organization should expect when they move ahead with SOA.
Sure, that's actually a really good idea because it's fundamental to understand these strategic benefits and goals, because once you do, they give a strategic context to everything else you learn about SOA, whether it's a technology, a design principle, a design pattern, a governance approach. Once you get it in terms of what we're trying to accomplish when we move toward an SOA-based environment, then you have a better appreciation as to why certain changes are required or why things need to be designed and maintained differently than with previous approaches. So what I'd like to suggest is that, if you don't mind moving along with me, if you could go to whatissoa.com, which is a site that has this information published in it.
Okay.
And when you get to that site, on the left you'll see there's a navigation bar. There's a section called Goals and Benefits of Service-Oriented Computing. If you click on the introduction link below that, you can see the different goals and benefits that I'll be talking about now. And you can see a diagram that actually separates those. you can basically categorize these individually as goals and benefits, where the first four we'll be discussing are more technical focused. They establish certain characteristics. They represent desired characteristics we want to establish with an SOA adoption. And if we do that successfully, they lead us to attain these ultimate goals and strategic benefits, which is represented by the latter three symbols in this diagram. So let's talk more about it. If you want to know the navigation pane there, go and click Intrinsic Interoperability. You'll see a link where we show different project teams delivering different services. When we talk about intrinsic interoperability, we want to establish an environment where the services, regardless of who they're built by or when they were delivered, any service within a specific service inventory will be naturally compatible with any other service in that inventory. So again, this is an inventory-based assumption, leading back to our previous discussions in our other podcasts about inventories and what they represent. Just to recap that quickly, they represent boundaries, collections of services that are independently standardized and governed. So the standardization part ties directly into attaining this goal, because for services to be intrinsically interoperable, to be naturally interoperable with each other, requires that they be consistently delivered as per some predefined conventions.
Okay.
And again, regardless of who delivers them or when they are delivered. So here we have on this diagram, you can see Project Team A and Project Team B, each delivering their own set of services. One is a timesheet, one is an invoice.
Sure.
They deliver it initially just for their own requirements. They have a particular business task to automate, and that is often the immediate concern. But because they are required to deliver these services as per these design standards and other considerations that all come from the service orientation design principles, the services are naturally, they're intrinsically interoperable, so that when the third project team comes along, Project Team C on this diagram,
okay,
it then now also, it needs an invoice service. It needs timesheet-related functionality. It is not required to build those services themselves because they already exist, but more importantly or more relevant to this goal, those services exist as intrinsically interoperable software programs. So they can now pull those two services that were delivered by those previous project teams together into their own solution with the absolute confidence of knowing that they are designed to work with each other. They don't have to now turn this into a big integration project to make two programs that were never designed to work with each other now connect and now exchange data and introduce all these types of transformation and brokerage type of functions. they don't need to do that because
Excellent.
The services are interoperable. And that's really fundamental to making a success out of an SOA project. And it doesn't matter if you're building services as web services or services as components. These standards have to be adhered to, and then you can work toward that. So this ties directly into service orientation. If you get a chance to go over to SOAprinciples.com, not now, but at some other point, you'll see that there's a whole section there that discusses how each of the 8 design principles that comprise service orientation support interoperability. That's why there is no one principle that is dedicated to interoperability. They all support that because it is so fundamental.
I see.
So let's move on to the next one. If you want to click Increased Federation, and you'll see another diagram there showing services that need to encapsulate different types of environments. So when we talk about federation, we're referring to a state where you have potentially disparate environments that are unified through some endpoint layer that represents standardized access into those environments, but we preserve the differences, the disparity among those environments. We don't unify the back end, we unify the front end by establishing what we call a federated endpoint layer.
Okay.
And that those endpoints are effectively service contracts that
okay.
are subject to design standards. So what this gives us is the freedom to evolve services over time while maintaining their contract. We can change the back end, we can rebuild some functions, we can refactor them and optimize them, or we can choose to replace the technology entirely. We might have a certain type of vendor we built the service with initially, and we choose to completely overhaul that and introduce new technology, as long as we preserve the service contract and preserve the behavior associated with the individual functions that we express through that contract, then we have that freedom to really take the service in any direction it needs to go over time. And because of service normalization, which we talked about during our last podcast, the services do not functionally overlap, and we are guaranteed that freedom to evolve them.
Excellent.
So increased federation is about achieving that harmonized state. From an endpoint perspective, if I'm a service consumer and I look at the endpoints that are available to me, and when we take other service orientation related considerations like service abstraction into account, which turns service into black boxes effectively, I may not have any knowledge of what lies underneath any of those endpoints. But because they're all consistent, I can understand them better, but more importantly, I can use them more effectively and combine them together. And because they're intrinsically interoperable, I can work with them without requiring explicit integration. They're just programs that can be connected together. I create a composition architecture and can now build a service-oriented solution based on that. So federation is important because we establish this layer of service endpoints across an inventory or across however much, to whatever extent an enterprise adopts SOA, and that provides a very effective means of using the service logic that each endpoint represents.
Great.
So let's move on to the next item. If you want to click the increased vendor diversification options link, you'll see a diagram there where we have the same 3 services that we were looking at before, still encapsulating disparate environments, but now we're identifying the actual technologies there, and that ties into this specific goal. One of the key things that we want to accomplish with any SOA implementation is to establish as much as we can a vendor-agnostic architectural model, to establish a model that is not dependent or locked into any one vendor platform, because vendor lock-in itself is something that's caused issues for organizations in the past and has made, at times, certain architectures less flexible when the business requirements of an organization change and the IT department tries to catch up, but is limited because it is locked into a very specific type of development or runtime platform. So with vendor diversification, we want to establish an environment and an architectural model that gives the organization the freedom to diversify its vendor technologies if required.
Okay.
So we're not advocating that the organization go out and get lots of different vendor technologies, because that comes with its own impacts in terms of new skill set requirements and different types of processes to maintain them and so on. So it's not about overly diversifying an environment, but what it is primarily about is establishing the constant option for an organization to diversify if required. Okay. So by not being locked into any one environment, if we do run into a situation or reach a point where now the business has evolved, it has new requirements, or is going in a different direction, we're now, as IT people, we have to respond to that by adapting, by building new logic, by fulfilling those new requirements. And if our current vendor product set cannot do that, we have this option to now diversify, to include, pull in, or even replace entirely using other vendor technologies. And so we can supplement with what we have, or we can do a wholesale migration, whatever the case may be. The point is we have the freedom of doing that without having to create a new technology architecture itself. The architecture remains. Parts of it get changed, but the architectural model we've established stays the same. The services, the federated endpoint layer stays the same because that is abstracted from the underlying service logic and its technology architectures. And we can now evolve, upgrade, refactor technology architecture as required by diversifying with other vendor technologies or even open source technologies, if that is the case, and essentially evolve the architecture in tandem with the business. And that's a key part of maintaining an agile and flexible environment. And that's one of the big things about SOAs, to establish an environment that maintains that state. So
absolutely,
that's what this goal is all about. And it's something we establish initially to then leverage in the future in fully preparing ourselves for change, which is usually inevitable in any organization. So that's fundamental to this. We can move on to the next one now, called increased business and technology domain alignment. And what this has to do with is essentially aligning services that represent those individual endpoints as part of that federated layer we talked about, aligning them to the business as much as possible. And that usually ties into the definition of business services. So we have two types of primary services that are usually delivered, those that are business-centric and those that are not. Those that are business-centric have functional contexts that are derived or aligned with business models, such as business entity diagrams, logical data models, business process definitions, so BPM type of deliverables. All these are very important and valuable to organizations because they document how the organization does its business, carries out its business, and those are something we look to capture as accurately as possible within business services. And we establish two separate layers. We establish single-purpose services that encapsulate business processes as they exist today. We establish entity-centric services that capture business entity logic that tends to remain more constant throughout how processes may change. So business processes may evolve over time, may go in different directions, or may have to change in response to new requirements. But usually, if the company itself remains within the same line of business, the entities themselves will remain relatively constant. Some organizations are an exception to this, but usually that's the case.
Okay.
And so for that case, we invest in creating an entity service layer and building those services to represent individual business entities. Examples of business entities might be, like we were talking about, invoice, timesheet, employee, claim, purchase order. All these represent business things that the business has to deal with. And the fact that you have to work with employees and purchase orders and invoices, that stays the same, but how you work with them may change. And that's why we have these two layers, the task service layer and the entity service layer. So the entity services tend to just get recomposed by changing task service logic as the business changes. Or, you know, again, you might introduce new entity services. At some point, you might drop some. But overall, there's a great deal of reuse to be had there. But in relation to this particular goal, the point is to capture the business logic as best as we can so that we can evolve our service inventories, again, in alignment with how the business itself evolves and always staying on top of that. So that's another key objective of doing SOA in the right way, essentially.
Great.
So let's cover these last three here quickly. So now we're getting into those three that we identified as strategic benefits resulting from the former four we just covered. And the one thing you'll often hear in association with SOA is an increased return on investment or increased ROI.
Yes, for sure.
So, as you can see in the diagram here, ROI is more emphasized than any other past design approach with SOA. We look to position services in such a way that they get reused to a very high extent. And the extent to which they do get reused often depends on the scope of the inventory. But because the inventory itself is cross-silo, represents a meaningful segment of the enterprise, the reuse potential is naturally greater. And we have to prepare services for that. That's what service orientation is all about as a design approach, is outfitting services, especially those that have what we call agnostic contexts, so that they can be effectively reused and recomposed repeatedly. But essentially, the big benefit of having services be intrinsically interoperable, of being able to refactor them by diversifying vendor technology if we need to, by having them in alignment, especially with agnostic types of business models that entity models tend to provide, all those things tie into the opportunity to maximize our return on investment. If you can see, there's a little metric there on that diagram. The delivery cost of the service on the bottom is shown as being plus 30% when compared to building the equivalent amount of logic using a more traditional design approach. But the payoff is greater because we are building these services to really be reusable and recomposable, and that's all ties into service modeling, upfront analysis, and it ties into service orientation as a design approach. So that's something that has to be taken into consideration. We invest more, but over time, we look to get a lot more from that initial investment, which is what the ROI goal is all about.
Excellent.
Okay, let's move over to organizational agility. Agility is something you'll often hear in relation to SOA, and there's some confusion around that because you have SOA and service orientation, which preach that you should do more upfront analysis and you should invest more in the delivery of services, and by doing so, it takes more time to deliver a service than it would a corresponding amount of logic using a traditional approach. But then you have agile development approaches where the focus is more tactical and bypassing an analysis and focusing on immediate requirements. That is agile in that you get what you need faster. When we talk about agility in relation to SOA, we're talking about achieving a state whereby you have a collection, an inventory of services, a mature inventory of services that have been standardized, that are intrinsically interoperable, that all comply to service orientation design principles, and a large portion of which are reusable or agnostic and therefore have multi-purpose applications.
Okay.
To achieve that state means that we have to invest more in each service and it takes longer to do so. So from the initial, and the key word there is initial, from the initial delivery perspective, service delivery can be less agile than traditional approaches because it takes more time and money to build them. But from this ultimate state that we're talking about, once you have the services in place, if you think about it, a common amount of services that we look to be agnostic is 80%. So if you have 80% of these services representing common logic that is common to many different tasks and processes within a particular domain, you can now, when you build a solution at that stage, you can now draw repeatedly from this inventory of services, assemble them together, and deliver a whole solution in significantly less time and with less effort and with less money than you would if you were to build a traditional silo-based application from the ground up, as many organizations have. At that point, solution delivery becomes much more agile because it takes less time, takes less money, and you get what you need a lot faster. The organization as a whole can become more responsive because now these new requirements come our way. We can fulfill them in a lot less time than if we had to build this from scratch or if we did not have all these things in place.
Sure.
So that's the key distinction. That's really important because I've seen this confuse in some people, and that's why the considerations that are raised by service orientation are so important to this. The diagram that we see here on this page just sort of illustrates what I was talking about. You can see if we had to build, we have a timesheet validation solution we need to build, and we have to build 100% of the logic. So a silo-based application that is being built from the ground up, it takes a certain amount of time and a certain amount of effort and money. If we were to build the same solution with a mature service inventory in place, we would require a lot less time and money. And we still have to build some logic that will be specific to that solution that does not yet exist within the services we have at our disposal, but we're only building 35% in this case.
Okay.
instead of 100%, and we were using 65% of what we already have. So there's also an ROI benefit there that's being communicated, but it's from a timeline perspective or from a time-to-market perspective, it's much, much more agile. And this is a very key benefit that many companies, especially those in the private sector, are extremely interested in. They want to achieve this state because they can see themselves being able to outmaneuver their competitors in certain business climates, being able to respond to regulations or policies much more faster, or being able to respond to client requirements more faster, or improving their business over others in a much more time-effective manner.
It becomes a true competitive advantage.
Exactly. It's a time-based advantage, and time for many organizations is just as important or directly linked to the amount of revenue they generate. So that's where this comes in, and that's the agility. This is often what we call here organizational agility. You'll often see referred to as business agility, but that's what it's about, and that's one of the key benefits we look to realize with SOA, and that's a lot of what we've discussed previously with regards to patterns and principles ties directly into that. So let's quickly just cover off the last one here. If you want to click on the link that's called Reduced IT Burden, if we think of everything we've just discussed, and what we end up with, we normalize services, we build, we avoid redundancy, and therefore reuse a lot of what we have. This establishes an environment where if you had a new company and you were to look at it today and build it from scratch via a silo-based approach over time, like let's say over 3 or 4 years, and you build individual applications that were tactically focused. Later on, you found out you had to integrate them, so you have to build these integration channels. And you end up with a certain inventory of applications. And that you could probably think of that as what you see on the top of the diagram here in this page, all these boxes being connected by lines. If you were to take the same company and start with a blank canvas and build services from scratch, customize them, make sure they comply to all the service orientation principles, and the architectural model is in line with the pattern languages in the SOA design patterns book and things like that. You take all these considerations into account, avoid as much redundancy as you can, and build a service from the ground up. You'll notice that for the equivalent amount of logic, the overall size of the enterprise is much smaller because you've avoided so much redundancy. And not only is it smaller, it is also more streamlined. All those services are intrinsically interoperable. They can be connected together to build whatever you need to build. You don't have to build these fixed integration channels with transformation technology. You have services that are much more nimble, can be composed into different configurations, recomposed when necessary, and will automate processes in a much more effective manner. So you end up with a state where you get more value out of every program you deliver as a service. The overall architecture and solution delivery is more agile, it's more responsive. And the size of the IT enterprise is smaller,
sure,
which would correspond then to a reduced operational cost and effort as well, because you have less to manage quantity-wise. So if we take all that into account, we summarize all that and call that as a whole a reduced burden of IT on the organization. One of the big things that organization heads have complained about in relation to IT in many sectors is that IT becomes this growing albatross that they're pulling along with them. It becomes a drain on the organization. It seems to consume more resources every year and provide less value. I mean, that may or may not be the case for individual companies, but often that has to do with the fact that IT enterprises evolved in such a manner that they built individual application silos, different projects built different applications. They fulfilled immediate requirements, but they were never designed to work with each other. When new requirements came their way, either they would build a new application or they would connect existing applications or some sort of hybrid between the two. And so they would end up with these bloated environments with more and more applications that would redundantly build the same type of logic in different ways, use different type of data models, and when they need to be connected, they use integration technology with transformation layers that were expensive and complex. And that leads to this silo-based environment that required the whole enterprise application integration era and all the middleware and just leads to this environment that has slowed down IT's responsiveness and increased its burden on the organization.
Yes.
With SOA, in a way, that whole era that produced that is one of the reasons that SOA came to be. It was in response to this alarming amount of counterproductivity that IT was imposing on organizations that a new way had to be established to produce an IT environment that could truly provide value without becoming such a drain. So this then represents this ultimate state. All the different goals and benefits we talked about previously lead up to this. If done the right way, if you carry out an SOA adoption the right way and you have sufficient resources and all those other requirements, you can achieve this, and you can achieve an environment where IT as a whole becomes much less of a burden on the organization, contributes more value, and allows the organization to be more responsive. So that's the big deal. That's the big vision. And again, it's good to keep that in the back of your mind as you learn about all the other different things in relation to SOA, because they all are intended to support this.
Excellent. I think every podcast needs to have its million-dollar question. I think you've just answered it. So thank you very much. We don't have time today, but during our next podcast, I'm hoping that we can focus more on the design principles and the approaches that actually work towards that vision.
Sure.
How does that sound?
Sure. Sounds good.
Excellent. Okay. And actually, one more question that I do think fits in here and into this particular podcast well, and if you could just answer it quite briefly, the SOA certification program.
Oh.
Can you give us just a minute or two on that?
Oh, sure. I mean, it's a program that, if you want to know more about it, you can go to soaschool.com. There is a series of official certifications that are available. We've had this for a while. There's the certified SOA consultant designation. We now have SOA analyst and architecture certifications. And in 2008, we're coming out with SOA Java developer, SOA .NET developer, and also SOA governance specialist and SOA security specialist certifications as well. They all are formally tested, and it's quite a rigorous program, but the idea is to have something in place that can legitimately turn practitioners into SOA professionals, just to improve the overall quality with which SOA projects are carried out.
Makes a lot of sense. Thank you. Thomas, thank you once again for this truly educational and interactive podcast episode. Your book, SOA Principles of Service Design, is, of course, currently available and with sample chapters. It's posted at soabooks.com, along with information about all the other titles in your Prentice Hall Service-Oriented Computing series. For all you listeners out there, Thomas's next book, SOA Design Patterns, is scheduled to publish in March of 2008. You can actually preview it, along with all the design patterns, at soapatterns.org. In addition to this book, there are 5 additional books that are being developed in the series and that will also publish starting in 2008. Thank you again for joining us today, and stay tuned for the next episode of On SOA Podcasts.